Let's start by looking back 20 years to the Earth Summit in Rio, when 172 governments met to debate global warming. They also opened a convention, now signed by 193 nations, to protect the world's biological diversity. Choosing a name for it was pretty easy. It's called the Convention on Biological Diversity. Actually, protecting diversity has, of course, proved to be a lot more difficult. You know, the dodo, the Falkland Islands wolf, the golden toad.
Although they were all extinct before the Convention on Biological Diversity was created, more relevant examples are the Pyrenean ibex and the Bygee River dolphin.
Ah, Ruth Alexander's here. Just when I thought you were extinct, Ruth. Anyway, thanks. Yes, the Bygee River dolphin, the Pyrenean ibex, the panda.
Pandas aren't extinct.
It's just a matter of time, isn't it? They've got it coming. Ridiculously impractical creatures.
We're not here to disrespect one of the world's cutest species.
No, we're not. This is serious. I know it's serious because I spoke to the top man at the Convention on Biodiversity, Braulio Diaz.
It's a big problem. We know from certain sources of data that species extinction has increased in rate in recent times. So we know it is a problem, and we know that the drivers behind the species loss are mostly increasing. So land conversion and degradation, pollution, climate change, all these drivers are still around and increasing. And of course, human population is still growing and consumption is growing, and most of that consumption is not sustainable.
So there's a problem, and we're here to figure out how big a problem it is, how many species are actually going extinct.
Now, the Convention on Biological Diversity does put a number on it. Here's a quote from Braulio Diaz's special advisor, Ahmed Joglav, from the convention's website.
We are indeed experiencing the greatest wave of extinction since the disappearance of the dinosaurs. Every hour, three species disappear. Every day, up to 150 species are lost.
Doesn't that suggest there are 50 hours a day?
Well, up to 50 hours a day, yes. I asked Ahmed Joglav's boss, Braulio Diaz, whether he could produce some slightly more rigorous numbers, and it turns out this isn't an easy question to answer.
We started to identify species in a more scientific approach since Linnaeus about 250 years ago, and we're still doing it. Current estimates of number of species can vary from, let's say, 2 million species to over 30 or even 100 million species. So we even don't have a good estimate to an order of magnitude of precision.
Actually, we can go back even further. In the 17th century, before Linnaeus was even born, the English naturalist John Ray was trying to work out the number of insect species.
The butterflies and beetles are such numerous tribes that I believe in our own native country alone, the species of each kind may amount to 150 or more. The fly kind will be found in multitude of species to equal, if not exceed, both the forementioned kinds. The creeping insects are also very numerous. Supposing then there to be 1,000 sorts of insects in this island, if the same proportion holds between the insects native of England and those of the rest of the world, the species of insects in the whole earth will amount to 10,000.
Scientists have found about 1 million insect species since then.
And they're discovering more all the time. 10,000 a year by one estimate. You can laugh at John Ray for getting it so wrong. Or you could stop to wonder whether future generations will laugh at us too. I went to meet Georgina Mace at London's Natural History Museum. She's a professor in the Centre for Population Biology at Imperial College London. And she accepts there's a lot we don't know.
Let's say there are somewhere around 7 to 10 million species on the Earth. That's an estimate. We don't know exactly. Of those, we've described less than 2 million. So the rest, we don't know what they are. They have no names. We don't have descriptions of them.
I think the problem goes deeper than that. Biologists don't even have a universally accepted definition of what a species actually is. Charles Darwin himself argued there will be times when it's impossible to say whether two animals are members of the same species or not. There are grey areas. Now, lots of definitions have been proposed since Darwin, some useful, but none of them totally resolve the issue.
But the biggest problem probably isn't the definition of what a distinct species actually is. It's the sheer logistical challenge of counting them.
And if we didn't know a species existed in the first place, we can hardly notice when it's gone.
So there are two things you could do about that. You could create a mathematical model, or, as Georgina told me, you could count what you know has gone extinct, even though you may well miss a lot.
The IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, has for many years maintained a list of threatened species. Now, if they're no longer around, they're called extinct. They've rolled off the end of that ladder to extinction, if you like.
And how do they know if they're no longer around?
Well, the criterion that the IUCN uses, which is this quite precautionary criterion, is that the species has consistently been looked for in appropriate places and at appropriate times and not been seen.
Are we confident that they're looking in enough places?
It's probably pretty good for birds and mammals. There's been a big effort over the last few years to ramp it up for amphibians and reptiles, but it's woefully inadequate. So that approach is never going to get us the answers we need.
Now, the IUCN has a list of 801 species which have gone extinct.
What, in the last week? I thought it was 150 a day.
No, 801 extinct species since the year 1500. Mostly animals, a few plants. But remember, this list comes from the subset of known species, not from the huge variety of unknown species out there, which, as Braulio Dias said, could be up to 100 million.
Which makes it sound like the whole thing's complete guesswork.
Georgina?
It's not exactly guesswork, it's modelling. What you then do is go, well, OK, let's not try and count species one by one and they're all their individual members one by one. Let's take an approach where we look at the pattern of species distribution over the world, we look at the habitat they're dependent on, and we look at rates of change in those habitats and make some extrapolations based on that. And if you do that, you end up with these very high rates.
Now, that model applies something called the species-to-area relationship to habitat loss. The simplest possible way to describe it is like this. An estimate is made of the number of species in a given area or habitat. The larger the area, the greater the number of species are said to be in it. Then the model gets worked backwards. The smaller the area, the fewer species are said to be in it. In other words, if you measure habitat loss, you can calculate, using the model, how many species must be being lost in that area, even if you don't know what those species actually are.
It's this model which, as Georgina says, has generated some very alarming numbers. But more recently, it's also generated a mathematical row, thanks to this man.
My name is Stephen Hubbell, and I'm a distinguished professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and also a senior staff scientist at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute.
Professor Hubbell thinks that...
Let's call him Stephen.
Stephen thinks the species-to-area relationship model relies on poor maths, and as a result, he says, there's a problem.
Well, for the past 40 years, people have been using a method that we show is biased, and it's biased too high. That is, it overestimates the extinction rate. The basic problem is that there is an expected relationship as you increase area with an increasing number of species found in the area. And people thought, well, it's straightforward just to run that curve backwards, reduce the area as if you were cutting down forest and losing habitat to find out how many species would be left. The problem is that we have modeled the species area curve by something called a power law.
Let's pause there a second. We're not going to get into what we mean by a power law. The point is that the relationship doesn't work the same way in reverse.
Well, it turns out that the method, when extrapolated backward, doesn't take into account the fact that you need to remove more area to get the whole range of a species than you need to remove area to find the first individual of a species.
In other words, Stephen says the model assumes that if you add, say, a hectare to your 5-hectare field, then you'll find, say, 5 new species, and that means that if you reverse the process and shrank the field, you'd lose 5 species. Stephen says that's not how it works, that in fact you need a larger area to eliminate a species than you do to discover one. He says if you correct the mistake in the model, it shows about half as many species are going extinct.
And Professor Hubbell did make...
Stephen
did make another interesting point about what kinds of species we're talking about in all this. He said that while many of us thinking about extinction might have in mind so-called charismatic animals like rhinos or whales or those ridiculous pandas, in fact, the overwhelming majority of species in the world aren't like that. Only a tiny fraction even have backbones. Many are microscopic and most aren't even named. He said we think too much about the beautiful animals.
Statistically, we overcount them all the time because we care about them. That is, the proportion of the world's species that are charismatic organisms is really tiny. You know, from a biomass point of view, this is a bacterial planet. There's more biomass in bacteria than all other life combined. Now, should we care about that? Well, bacteria run the world. They run our gut systems. They help us to digest food, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, it's a very parochial view to assume that we should care only about elephants and zebras and not about bacteria.
I think one of the problems for many people trying to call attention to species loss is that while perhaps it's true that we should care about bacteria, most people care a lot more about the charismatic animals. And there just aren't many examples of those kind of animals going extinct. Braulio Diaz agrees with Stephen Hubble that we shouldn't focus too much on big furry animals. But even so, it was striking that when I asked him to name something that had actually gone extinct in the last few years, he struggled.
You only have to look at the IUCN data set at global level to realize there have been several species that have gone extinct in the last century, for example. I can give you example of Brazil, where I came from. We have some species of macaws that are very threatened. There's one particular species called the Styx macaw, where the population went extinct in nature. Fortunately, there are still a few individuals kept in captivity and reproducing, so there's still a hope in the future to increase their numbers and be able to return them to the wild habitats.
However you look at all this, it's obvious that no one can safely quantify what's going on. When Ahmed Joglav from the Convention on Biological Diversity told the world,
every hour, three species disappear. Every day, up to 150 species are lost.
He couldn't possibly know that to be true, whichever one of those two statements he actually meant. In fact, it seems that any firm number put on species loss, however big or small, is going to be spuriously precise. We just don't know.
But let's be clear. Everyone we've spoken to in researching this item thinks there is a problem. That includes Stephen Hubble, who says he worried about whether disputing the numbers would make people complacent about species loss. In the end, though, he thought it was more important to share what he'd found.
My bigger worry is that scientists not use flawed methods, because I am a scientist. So I am concerned that we give the most accurate methods a chance to work rather than ones that we know to be flawed. So when you find a mistake, you are, as a scientist, obligated to notify everyone that we've made a mistake and we need to fix things. And so, there's been a reaction from my colleagues about this. We were warned by some of them not to publish our paper, but that's not advice that I felt I was morally able to take.
Stephen Hubble of the University of California, Los Angeles. And, of course, Ruth Alexander.